Welcome to Breakthrough Thinking's Understanding Autism. I'm Kim Isaac. I'm a co-host of this radio show. I'm also an autism specialist. I specialize in working with teens and adults on the spectrum, as well as working with families who have kids on the spectrum. And today I'm very excited to introduce, we have a special guest with us. We have Rob Baer. He is an adult on the spectrum, and he's here to share some of his experiences with us and also talk about corporate cultures and autism. And so, Rob, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, I'm 58 years old, grew up in the Midwest. Spent most of my, obviously, I've been autistic since I was born. Had the experience of growing up over time and having a career. I'm now retired out of software engineering. Of being autistic but not knowing so. I found out about 2 years ago. However, unlike many autistic people, I had a pretty good career. I worked for a lot of Fortune 100s. I bounced around a lot. But I worked for a lot of Fortune 100s, a lot of large companies, was on a lot of projects, and was actually very successful. Which surprises me at this point, understanding how autism normally affects people and looking back and seeing how it affected my career and the situations I was in. One thing I'll point out at the beginning of the show before we start any of the shows is that I was effectively oblivious in some ways. I didn't know I was autistic. I didn't realize a lot of the nonverbal things that were going on around me, and actually that contributed to my success. There's an old saying that people do the impossible by not knowing that it's impossible, and aren't there other variants, Kim, of that saying that you can think of?
Not that I can think of, but I understand what you're saying.
Yeah, and so basically if I had known I was autistic and the people around me had known I was autistic and I'd had that label, I'd have probably gone nowhere, to be quite honest. But oddly, what made things work was obliviously having my focus on the business objectives and technical objectives at hand and just simply proceeding undaunted. So, yep.
Okay. So I know you have some, you know, things you wanted to share as it relates to your experience in your career. And you're in the corporate environment that you're in, and you know how autism was a, you know, how you as a person were affected by this corporate culture and where your autism came into play,
well,
can you tell us about that?
Yeah, fundamentally, it all comes back really to the differences in the way that an autistic person communicates, which is in my case, I can't communicate using facial expressions or tone of voice. I'm 58 years old, although if I go to a bar in California, I'll get carded, not because they think I'm under 18, but because by law, if somebody is under 30, they have to card them. Otherwise, the bartender can be cited. So I don't have the lines in my face, as you can see, Kim, I think.
Oh.
Yeah, Kim is looking directly at my face right now. Yeah.
Very nice skin, smooth skin.
Thank you very much. I shaved my head, and I think that's what she's probably talking about.
And we're going to post a picture. Ooh, I'm glad you brought this up. We're going to take a photo. We're going to post a picture of Rob, too, so you can see his smooth skin.
Yeah, there you go. There you go.
Go ahead.
In any case, many things that occur in corporate politics are communicated nonverbally. Looking back, I see that now with crystal clarity because it really fills in a lot of gaps. And when you think of autism, it seems like they always have got a puzzle there with one or two pieces missing. Well, in my autistic life, a lot of those pieces have fallen perfectly into place and they're a perfect fit and I understand what was going on. Many things, and for those of you who are listening who are neurotypical, there are situations where you're in groups, in a workplace, et cetera, where you just kind of know something from osmosis. You know, you don't have to think about riding a bike, but you don't fall down. You get on, you ride, and it's fine. Social situations for you are a lot the same. For those of us who are autistic, we fall down a lot. Now, and it's because there are two different channels of communication. There is the verbal, very explicit form, and then there's the nonverbal, body language, et cetera. And I'm absolutely shocked. One of the big surprises was the amount of information that is transmitted that way, to the extent that sometimes people will tell you something explicitly that is very clear, but then negate it in a nonverbal way. Or they'll tell you what you want to hear in order to be polite, but negate that in a nonverbal way. I never knew that occurred until 2 years ago at 56 years old.
Wow.
So it was kind of like realizing, if you see these movies where, like, Bruce Willis was in one where he was walking around, he thought he was alive and then realized he was dead and a ghost. It's not exactly like that, but it's kind of a metaphor of it. So in corporate politics, there are lots of things occur and are communicated that nobody can say for a lot of reasons. Sometimes it's plausible deniability. Sometimes it's courtesy, just not rubbing something in someone's face. Sometimes it's because of the capability of the person who's communicating. You know, and just think back. I'm sure that all of you that are listeners have had a time in your life when somebody you heard somebody say, "I just couldn't tell so-and-so something. I just couldn't tell you this." They knew it, they wanted to tell you, but they just couldn't bring themselves to do it. Very often that sort of thing is communicated nonverbally. So they do what's polite, what's acceptable, what they've got guts and gumption enough to do in a verbal sense, and then the part that is avoidant comes through nonverbally. Kim, is that your experience? Do you think that's within a normal variation for somebody like me and autistics in general?
I do. I see that a lot with the individuals that I work with, and I that's definitely very common.
Yeah. Yeah, and there aren't there something like, and autism is not, when they say the spectrum, it's not something that is continuous from you are profoundly autistic to you are mildly autistic. It's actually like a star field, a bucket of symptoms that occur together, and that's why it's essentially a syndrome, correct, Kim?
Exactly.
Yeah. Within the various variants of what's in the spectrum, even people that have Tourette's, et cetera, there are something like 3.6 million of us in the United States. Is that correct?
I think that's about right. I know the numbers, sometimes different numbers will come out, I'll see online, but I think that's...
Yeah. So a fairly firm figure is at least 1 in 88 people have some sort of characteristics. I saw a recent study that said 1 out of 50, although that's somewhat disputed right now. And I don't think disputed as in it's bogus, but they're looking at trying to verify the validity of the study. In any case... do you have a further question, Kim?
I actually do have a question. I know I get asked this a lot as a professional, but you being, you said you're 58 now. I know, looking at you, again, we're going to post a pic. No one will believe this unless they see it. But anyway, you know, I get asked a lot about getting a diagnosis later on in life. So many people are surprised. Like, how did this person go through their whole life and you know, not know or get a diagnosis? And I was just wondering if you could talk for a few minutes about that and how that was, what that was like for you.
Well, the reason you can stumble through life as if you're in the dark is because you are in the dark. You don't realize that something is missing. It is truly a disability. So it's kind of like if you were born blind. No one told you were blind, never learned about the concept of light, and then all of a sudden here you are 56 years old and the lights come on. Well, kind of, sort of. You realize that light is out there, but you still can't see it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how it happens. When I talked earlier about being oblivious to the characteristic that I've got, but understanding that some people responded to me in ways that were not what I saw as appropriate to my intent or what I was doing, that was an absolute surprise to me, and I would never have figured it out had it not been for a particular girlfriend, a girl that I'd started dating, who angrily brought it to my attention. Would you like me to tell that story?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay. This is kind of funny. And by the way, this is a lighthearted show, and those of you who are listeners, feel free to laugh at anything that's funny, because I'm not sensitive about these things. Don't be guilt-ridden if you find humor in these, because I do myself. I had a girl that I'd started dating. She was nice. She was over at my place. We were hanging out. And then out of the blue, she seemed to kind of radiate this extreme disappointment, discomfort, whatever, toward me. And she headed toward the door of my house. And I said, "Are you taking off?" And she said, "Yeah." And she somewhat angrily told me, "I think you have Asperger's syndrome. There's something wrong with you." And I'd had a few complaints earlier. Now, I've had plenty of girlfriends, and some of them for a matter of years. But there were some that complained that I missed the signals, I wasn't doing things at the right time. And I had always attributed that to the whole idea that women expect men to read their minds. Well, not only can I not read their minds, I can't read a lot of their body language or any of the nonverbal communication. She left, but basically in a very scolding tone of voice, very assertive manner, said, "You need to check to see if you've got Asperger's syndrome." She had read about that in some sort of popular literature. She hadn't read like a textbook or a diagnostic manual, anything like that, but she'd read a story that went into people like Bill Gates, et cetera. So it was more entertainment than information. But she actually spotted it fairly well. I went up, looked at it online, got some brain food, a little bit of information to think about, but then didn't follow up right away. But I thought about it over a matter of months. And then eventually, about 2 years ago to the day, it was in March 2 years ago, I actually started very seriously doing research, bumped into a couple of online tests. And depending on what you consider flunk or pass, I passed as an autistic with flying colors. I didn't have all of the systems. My numbers weren't hugely high, but I was definitely in that range, and that was a shock. It was pleasant news in that I understood what was going on with me, but when I read the stories of other autistic people, especially younger people, and how they weren't that much different than me, maybe no different than me, and their lives were an absolute mess, they never got started, they had no career, they never got through college, I was absolutely appalled. If you think about driving down the road and you hit that dip in the road and your stomach falls out from underneath you, or when you're flying in an airplane and you hit some turbulence, that's the sort of physical feeling I had. I was just, I didn't feel bad for myself, but I felt bad for that 3.6 million other people.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know what, let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll continue our discussion with Rob Baer, and we'll be right back.
Birenbaum and Spean PC, we want to help you work on your business, not in your business. We take a simple approach. You know your business. Our firm gives you the information to make those decisions better. Our firm takes a proactive approach to your accounting needs, and if you look behind the numbers, you'll find there are hidden opportunities that we try to impart on you. communication is the key to that understanding, and there is no charge for brief phone calls. Contact us at 602-266-5633 or email us at mitch@jfbpc.com. Birnbaum and Spean works to increase your understanding of your business in order to make the decisions necessary to move your business forward.
Ridenour, Heinten & Lewis is a multi-practice law firm, ideally equipped to assist with a broad range of legal and business issues in corporate and financial transactions, real estate, commercial, litigation, bankruptcy, and private client practice. Ridenour, Heinten & Lewis is a law firm that bases its practice on understanding the businesses of their clients, and they use this insight to meet each client's unique and evolving legal challenges. Call or click today, 602-254-9900. Find them on the web at rhkl-law.com.
Do you owe money to the IRS? Have you heard of possible payment options such as a partial payment installment agreement, offering compromise, or not currently collectible status? Knowing that you have options and what those options are will greatly relieve your worry and stress. Hi, my name is Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor. If you are curious as to what options may be available to you if you owe money to the IRS, my 25 years experience as a CPA may very well help you in these times of uncertainty. Stop worrying and start learning about what options you have. If you just want to talk to someone about your IRS debt or want specific advice, I invite you to call me at 602-625-3074. That is 602-625-3074. And when you call, ask for me, Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor.
Welcome back to Breakthrough Thinking's Understanding Autism. I'm Kim Isaac. I'm a co-host of this radio show, and of course I have my co-host Paul Loudon calling in from Houston. Paul, are you there?
Hi. Yeah, I'm here.
Hi. Okay, and we have our guest Rob Baer, who is an adult on the autism spectrum, and he's been sharing a little bit of his background, and actually I think he wanted to talk to Paul. Rob wants to talk to Paul.
Yeah, hi, Paul. How are you doing? This is our first time chatting.
Yeah, I was actually here for most of the last segment. I just got in a couple seconds late and missed the intro, so I heard your stories.
Yeah. Hey, Paul, if you would, we're both autistic. One of the popular misconceptions of people, and it's not their fault, but they watch a movie like Mercury Rising, they watch this kid, they really get fascinated by him, and so they now know what autism is. Or they hear something in the news and, oh, that's what autism is, or that's what Asperger's syndrome is. Actually, if you think about it, everybody recognizes a fingerprint, but every fingerprint is different. And as autistics, because there are so many different symptoms and characteristics that not only can exist or not exist, but exist in variation, we're all different. Paul, do you see any likenesses, differences after you've heard what you have of my story and my experiences? Do you compare it all to me or contrast to me?
I think that a lot of what I heard of your story is echoed in just so many other stories. The not getting facial expressions. The you told that story about the girl who had read something and decided that you had Asperger's. I mean, in a way, that's sort of – I could have read the same article she did, except I read it, I guess, 7 years before. I read an article, and it talked about – I think it talked about a man named Richard Stallman, who's involved in Linux development, and how he might have Asperger's. But it was the same kind of thing that I think that, a lot of these – autism is – autism is defined by the similarities between people with it, that a lot of these things are things that we all sort of experience in one way or another. It may not be the details are the same, but if you abstract enough, it's very similar. So, yeah, I see a lot of similarity in between what you experienced and what I did. I mean,
Mm-hmm.
I was diagnosed late in life, not as late as you, but 23, late enough to experience a lot of things. But where you managed to find a niche where you could, you know, work for these companies and find jobs that you could accomplish things at, I managed to make it just out of high school before things really started falling apart. So, you know, there are similarities and there are differences, but that's part of why, you know, it's described as a spectrum.
Paul, what do you think? And when I look back and I see youngsters, now I taught a class a couple of summers ago to a bunch of autistic students who were having trouble mostly with socialization, but they were really having trouble overcoming the label. And I've noticed that since I have had a formal diagnosis now, and I talk to people about it, or if I introduce myself and I say, hey, I might be a little bit odd to be around, this is why, it very often turns into an instant barrier that putting a label on my autism almost seems to maximize the issues. What have you noticed, you know, since the time came that you had a label to put on yourself? How has that affected you?
Well, one story
I
tell a lot of the show.
Are people more accepting of you?
Sorry. I would say is one thing I talk about a lot on the show is for me personally, the label was useful because, you know, as a programmer, you can't fix a bug until you find it. It's the same thing. Without the label, you don't know what you're looking for. When the debugger tells you you're missing a comma at the end of the line, that's a lot more helpful than it just says it's not working. So having a label is really helpful for me, but I have noticed this where, you know, when you meet people, once you share that label with them, any preconceptions they have about autism crop up and get in the way. And that's, you know, a big challenge for all of us on the spectrum is, you know, is self-advocating, is showing people that, you know, I am autistic too, that what you've seen on TV, what you've seen, you know, in the movies or what you've read about in articles is not the only autism. And so, yeah, the label is sort of a hit and miss thing. And I think that, you know, for me, people ask me when to disclose the label. And I'm always like, well, I want them to know me first, because I want to be Paul who has autism rather than that autistic guy, Paul. I want them to be thinking about me as a person first, so I want them to know me long enough. But that can be hard, you know, in a high school or something where, you know, someone who has special needs is introduced into the classroom and they get extra time on the test, and so everyone in the classroom knows there's something different or wrong with this person. And I think that, you know, that's actually the other side of dealing with autism. I talk about bridging the gap. And you don't build a bridge from one side. If you build a bridge from one side, you're going to overextend and fall. You have to meet halfway. And that's one of those things that, you know, programs and schools need to do, and programs in general, is work on educating people about what autism really means and what it means to interact with someone who's on the spectrum. And that's, you know, one of the big goals of our show here, and the advocacy I do is to try to show people, you know, autism can be a lot of different things. So, yeah, the label is a sort of scary and dangerous thing right now, but I think that, you know, the answer isn't to try to avoid or hide the label, but rather to embrace it and define it and take control of it, because until we take control of the label, you know, we can't really, you know, we can't stop people from using it, and we need control of it to define it.
Yeah, that's actually an important point. Even the label itself has changed, because I refer to myself as an autistic, even though it's not proper use of the term. Proper term is autist, but regretfully, that term has been stolen. That is now a term used for somebody who basically goes down in the basement, isolates themselves, and lives on the internet without talking to somebody. So these people who are gamers that do the other such things, if you refer to yourself as an autist, they don't even relate to actual autism anymore. So that's a term that's been lost, regretfully. So how do you refer to yourself, by the way, Paul? When you go out and you're going to introduce yourself, do you say, I am autistic, or I'm an autistic, or how do you do that?
You know, see, I like to say I have autism rather than I am autistic. Because I think that just verbally positions it more as an aspect of me than what I am. Because I'm not the disorder. It's just something, you know, I don't, you know, say that, you know, I'm brown hair. I say I have brown hair. It's just an aspect of me. So I like to try to phrase it like that. I was diagnosed with autism. You know, I have autism. I try to speak about it that way most of the time.
That's a good point. I'll make a mental note of that, because I have been referring to myself as an autistic, and I think I might be able to position myself a little bit better. So thanks for the hint, Paul.
Oh, no problem.
Let's take a short break.
Yeah,
oh,
yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
Okay. Well, I was just going to say is that that was me trying to that's one thing I talked about a few shows back is person-centric language, and that you just try to always put the person first rather than defining them as the condition. Anyway, you mentioned we should probably take a quick break.
Yeah, let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll continue our discussion with Rob Baer. He's an individual on the spectrum, and he's talking to us about some of his life experiences, and he's going to be talking with us about some of his career experience in corporate America, and we will be right back.
Birenbaum and Spean PC, we want to help you work on your business, not in your business. We take a simple approach. You know your business. Our firm gives you the information to make those decisions better. Our firm takes a proactive approach to your accounting needs, and if you look behind the numbers, you'll find there are hidden opportunities that we try to impart on you. Communication is the key to that understanding, and there is no charge for brief phone calls. Contact us at 602-266-5633 or email us at mitch@jfbpc.com. Birenbaum and Spean works to increase your understanding of your business in order to make the decisions necessary to move your business forward.
Ridenour, Heinsohn & Lewis is a multi-practice law firm, ideally equipped to assist with a broad range of legal and business issues in corporate and financial transactions, real estate, commercial, litigation, bankruptcy, and private client practice. Ridenour, Heinsohn & Lewis is a law firm that bases its practice on understanding the businesses of their clients, and they use this insight to meet each client's unique and evolving legal challenges. Call or click today, 602-254-9900. Find them on the web at rhkl-law.com.
Do you owe money to the IRS? Have you heard of possible payment options such as a partial payment installment agreement, offering compromise, or not currently collectible status? Knowing that you have options and what those options are will greatly relieve your worry and stress. Hi, my name is Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor. If you are curious as to what options may be available to you if you owe money to the IRS, my 25 years experience as a CPA may very well help you in these times of uncertainty. Stop worrying and start learning about what options you have. If you just want to talk to someone about your IRS debt or want specific advice, I invite you to call me at 602-625-3074. That is 602-625-3074. And when you call, ask for me, Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor.
Welcome back to Breakthrough Thinking's Understanding Autism. I'm Kim Isaac. I'm a co-host of this radio show. And, of course, I have co-host Paul Loudon calling in from Houston. And today
Hi.
We have a guest, Rob Baer. He's an adult who has autism, and he's here sharing some of his experiences. And I had an opportunity to spend some time with Rob a couple of months ago, and he used this term that I thought was really fascinating, and it relates to the experiences he's going to share, but failure by success, this phrase that you have, and it's fascinating to me. And I guess, can you talk to us a little bit about what that means to you and how it relates to your experiences?
Well, as I said earlier, much of the communication, political communication that takes place within a corporation is nonverbal. There are very, very important things that are communicated that aren't said and can't be said. And this is one of those circumstances where I did exactly what I was asked to do in an abstract sense and specific sense, did so ahead of time, under budget, with early delivery, and did exactly the opposite of what they really wanted me to do. They gave me lots and lots of hints along the way. I didn't take any of the hints. Why? They were nonverbal. All I saw was that I had a bunch of unexpected things jump up in front of me. And so, having some initiative, wanting to make my career go, I overcame those. But in the process, I did something, and I'm going to save the kicker for the end. As you people are listening to the story, you'll be able to see, especially the neurotypical people who understand how to navigate the world of nonverbal communication, you'll know something's going on, and you'll see that the hints are there. At the end, I will tell you why actually what they were doing was very rational and very smart, given the entire scope of business and how companies operate. Got a question? Or
no, I guess we were talking about on the break that you were going to, so we gave some background, and then you and Paul had an opportunity to talk a little bit, but you have, I guess taking us into from you graduated college,
oh,
moving into your career
right.
experience.
Right. Well, I'll give you a quick before story. I got a degree in computer science, and then after graduating, returned to my hometown, like a lot of people do, and had a small consulting business there. It was general consulting. Now, my love has been software and data and large architecture. Love that stuff. Was unable to do it in my hometown. I did some of it, but not a lot and enough that you could call a career. So, the kind of things I was doing, which was legitimate work, was everything from running network wires, installing printers, doing repairs, a broad gambit of things. I had scheduled a point at which if I was unable to do full-time software and data in that town, that I was going to go back to college, get a master's degree, and then move somewhere else and have the career that I really wanted. So I went back to college, was in graduate school, and by the way, graduate school went really well. I even had one semester where I got a perfect 4.0 with an overload, and I had two classes where I got every point in the class. I had not a single missed point. So I did well in graduate school. Toward the end of graduate school, I was really eager to get to work. I found a consulting company that did work for a local Fortune 100 manufacturer and approached that consulting company and, basically gave them a resume, filled out an application, and said, hey, have you got something for me to do? And they said, well, we can't think of anything right now. Maybe we'll call you back. And two or three days later, almost right away, they call me back and say, we've got the perfect gig for you. Since you're an older guy who's been around for a while and worked with older systems, plus you're in graduate school and so you're up to date on newer systems, we have at our Fortune 100 client an issue that they've contacted us about. They have an old software program that runs under DOS, which is basically a command line program system that most of you have never seen because people stopped using it in around 1995. But they had this program. It was very important. It was fully functional, but some of their strategic partners were starting to use computers that ran Windows, which is a graphical user interface. They wanted to find a way to get this program, older program, to run under Windows. Now, when I was initially approached about it, I'm thinking, and what else? Because at that time, versions of Windows were made to host DOS programs in several different ways. It had three different ways you could do it. They were all straightforward. You know, the 14-year-old kid down the block could do it. So I'm wondering, why do these guys need my help to do it? But you know what? It's a temp thing. They want me to come in and do it. Maybe they just don't have time. Got into an interview with a client, and they said, well, we've tried and we failed, but we have to give it this last try. We're going to contract you for 6 months, and if you fail at the end of 6 months, we'll understand. So don't get too shook up about this. So I said, fine. I did, and I was signed on for the gig. Now, I did notice that my manager for the consulting company seemed to reinforce over and over that I didn't need to feel any pressure to get this done within the 6 months, that it wasn't something that was necessary to succeed at, that if it failed, no big deal, and it wouldn't be a black eye for me. And then when I got into the account, the manager there basically reinforced the same thing over and over again. Well, I quite optimistically say, hey, you know what? And I basically told him, you know, this is the kind of thing a 14-year-old kid down the block does. I think I'm going to be able to get this done in a hurry. Is there any penalty for early delivery? You know, and no, we got plenty of work to do around here. We could keep you busy for years, no problem. So, Fine. Now, for those, you know, Kim, Paul, et cetera, do you see any hints, any patterns in what was going on early in this? I think it pretty well drew lines around it.
Well, I'm not a good one to ask because you've already told me this story. I've heard it. I don't want to give away what you're trying to illustrate.
Okay, Paul?
Well, I mean, you sort of telegraphed it at the beginning when you said that there were hints. Because, I mean, going into this, you know, my assumption would be that whoever I was talking with was technologically clueless if they were saying that it's just an issue of getting a DOS app to run. I assume you're talking, you know, Windows 3.1 or something like that, you know.
Windows 95.
You know, clearly,
yeah.
Oh, 95 still, you know, still has 16-bit support, so, you know, whatever. You know, I would have been like, okay, so these guys want this done, but clearly they don't know what they're doing, and this is probably going to be a lot easier than they think it is. But, you know, you've been telegraphing it, so, you know, I assume that they didn't really want it done because the longer they take, the more they can charge.
Yeah. Actually, they had plenty of people that were as good as doing that sort of thing and could have done it fairly quickly. Well, anyhow, I get in, I sit down in my cube, and I have absolutely nothing sitting there. I have no computer to use, anything like that. And I start asking, where's my stuff to get going? And, well, it'll come. Well, at that point, I'm very concerned because I'm thinking, geez, if the ball gets dropped, what if I get blamed? Or what if they just cancel? What if they want to do this, but they just don't coordinate things? And at the end of the week, I have nothing to show. And they decide, well, we're going to cancel on this. I guess nobody's enthused about it. So I started self-expediting. And honestly, when I have a lot of the autistic people I've met do similar things. They get excited. They love what they're doing. They want to get into solving the problem. And so when things stop, they try to expedite. They try to get the ball rolling again. And that's what I did. And so I ran around for about 2 weeks expediting getting computers, getting a power strip, et cetera. There was also in my cube, there had been an individual in it that for one reason or another had light sensitivity. So they had the lights removed above the cube, and there was no light in the cube. It was tough to read, very, very tough to read. And those were in the very early days of the Internet. There wasn't the kind of stuff online like there is now, so you need to bring in books, prints, stuff like that to look at. And I couldn't read my cube. So, and this is a very political environment in many ways, I decided to bring in a desk lamp. Okay, so I get the desk lamp, I bring it in, I set it up on my desk, plug it in, turn it on, and a short time later, somebody has turned me into the manager I'm working for having a desk lamp. Why is this a problem? Well, that particular company has a union. And while I can plug in a computer and a printer just fine because they're computer equipment and the computer people can do that, I can't plug in a light. I can't even change a light bulb. So I got a pretty stern lecture about that and had to immediately unplug the light and take it out and put it in my car. I had no light there. So I ask about what can I do as far as getting an overhead light reinstalled. Okay, I'm going to telegraph this hint. They tell me, well, once every 30 days, somebody comes through and checks bulbs to see which ones are flickering and burning out. And so what we'll do is we'll schedule to have the guy actually put bulbs back in the fixtures over your cube when he comes through. Oh, really? When's that going to be? Well, he just came through, so it's probably going to be a month. And so I said, well, can I get a desk lamp from somewhere, some sort of lamp? Well, let's go look in the back. We might have one back there. Can we go look? Well, I suppose we could. Can we do it now? Well, I suppose we can. And you can imagine the banter, and the individual I was talking to was, obviously looking back, was trying to give me the hint, don't put a light on your desk, just sit there in the dark and collect your paycheck. But I insisted, we went and got the light, or talked about the light, but couldn't get the light. They had to actually schedule an electrician. It was an electrician showed up. It was a full five-hour morning for that electrician. It must have cost them hundreds of dollars to have this guy show up, plug the light in, turn it on, shut it off, and say, voila, you have a light on your desk now. Very political environment in all ways. So, anyhow, I've now got light, and I'm supposed to develop this solution to run on Windows 95. Where's Windows 95? They don't have a copy for me. And they aren't going to be able to get a copy for me for at least a month. So, Paul, what do you think I did? Just speculate.
You know, what I probably would have done is just brought in, you know, an old copy from home, you know, and then you get in trouble about the licenses, but, you know, especially, you know, earlier I wouldn't have been aware of that, so I would have just, you know, brought my own copy and tried to work on my own hardware, possibly.
Well, that's basically you covered all the points, because I had Windows 95 at home, although I did not want to use a version that I had installed on one of my machines or registered to myself. So I took $100, went over to a local computer store, and for $99 and, you know, plus tax, bought a copy of Windows 95 brand new in the box, brought it into work, and started using it. Now, the manager came over and asked me about it. Where did this come from? And I said, I bought it. And she said, well, what are we going to do about licenses? And I said, we can do anything you want. When I'm done, the solution will not involve a license for software. But if you're nervous about it, I'll just give it to you. You can keep it. You got my $100 worth of software, and I'm happy to do that because I want to get going on the project. She was noticeably angry, and I really didn't understand why. And I was trying to make it so that no matter what, it turned out well for her and her company, that they had this project done. And the weird thing about it is that here I am trying to perform very, very well, deliver ahead of time, under budget. If it's a critical business need, the sooner they get it, the better. So I can't imagine that what I'm doing isn't exactly right, isn't a good thing for the company. Well, anyhow, that she begrudgingly said, okay. And I continued, and I worked very hard. There were three other projects that came up. I did those successfully, and in about 6 weeks' time, even though there were lots of impediments, lots and lots of impediments, got a solution to them, and it worked. When I showed up and said to her, I got a solution, we're ready to test, even being autistic, I could see the fury on her face. Mad as hell.
When you told her you were finished with the project.
When I had it ready to go, and it was about 6 weeks. So she said, well, okay, we'll see about testing it, but we're going to need to find somebody to test it and blah, blah, blah. And it took some time to do that. But eventually it did get tested. It worked fine. And I thought, okay, I want to stay with this company a while. I want to show that I can not only fix their old stuff, but work with the new stuff. So I'm in graduate school. I can get a discount on software. Now, this is years ago, before everything came with a CD writer built into them, et cetera. I spent $400 on a CD writer, about $250 on a SCSI interface card for the CD writer, about $100 on software, $180 on Visual Studio, and basically stubbed in program to start. Actually created the beginning of a solution. I took that in, put it on a CD, installed it as if it was professional commercial software, and her hair about stood on end, and I couldn't believe it. So where did all this go? How did all of this end up? I didn't find out until later after I'd left the gig. And by the way, they didn't keep me there for 6 months. I was technically there over a duration of a year, but I was there for the initial 6 to 8 weeks, and then I came back for a few days at the end. I had a magnetic card get in and out, but they didn't have any work for me, even though they had lots of work to do. While I was away from the company, I bumped into a coworker, and he said to me, Rob, everybody liked you. Everybody wanted you there. You know, why did you do what you did? Conversation continued, and I couldn't understand what was going on. I'll cut to the chase. In big corporations, there are some things that can be said and some things that can't. In particular, the manager that I was working for had been there about 25 years. She was tired of her job and wanted to do an early retirement. In that company, unspoken, normal choreography is that when an individual is, they've been there a long time, they've earned their dues, they do this sort of choreography where they position themselves as being in some way obsolete. And so they get an early retirement. Now let's look through a couple of scenarios here, Paul, if you would. Imagine, and we're going to look at two perspectives, and this is why it was absolute failure for basically everybody, what I did. Let's say you're a manager, been at a company for 25 years, you're in your late 40s, not even 50 yet, and you want to retire. How do you go to the executives of your company or the managers of your company above you and say, you know what, I'm not old enough to retire, but I'm tired. I really don't want to do my job anymore. I've lost interest. I don't know that much about what's going on. Will you just give me an early retirement, pay me a bunch of money to go away? How would you do that, Paul?
You know, I can't answer that because it's not something I can imagine doing. So, but I guess what we're talking about here is that your manager was positioning yourself as not really competent to handle the modern challenges, so that instead of her asking for that, she put herself in a position where they would ask her to leave.
Right, and that is exactly what was going on. However, the way she was positioning herself was being attached to a piece of software that would have to be obsoleted. That's what she managed. And so if the piece of software was obsoleted, she would be able to leave. So.
Yeah, so, wow, I know I've heard that story. I know you have so many other stories. I can't believe we only have 8 minutes left. But I guess my question is, so hearing this story, you know, I can imagine being on the spectrum and, you know, here you are going back to this failure by success. I mean, you're doing everything right. You're making decisions. You're going above and beyond. You know, you're trying to do the right thing. And I just can't imagine, you know, finding all of this out later and, you know, just not being able – I mean, I guess, too, there's kind of a couple of issues. Because I'm not in the corporate world, I don't understand that culture at all. You know, there's kind of that issue. But then on top of that, not being able to understand unspoken, you know, quote, rules or nonverbal communication.
Yeah, you can't learn them. You can't even, I can't even, and people like me can't even learn them in principle. We don't even know that's going on in general, much less a specific instance. So we're clueless. We are actually clueless. Now, Kim, you're a woman. Imagine, and I'd like to approach this from another perspective. Let's say you're the Fortune 100 employer, and this is the other half of the unspoken part of the choreography. How do they approach you and say, listen, you're way over 40, not 50 yet, you're old, you're stale, would you just please resign and leave or whatever, or even take an early retirement? How do they do that? Those things can't really be said to you. You'd sue them?
I can't imagine. People, they may be thinking that, but that's not something that
you can say
in our culture, you know, is considered good manners,
so these
even though it's sort of maybe honest.
Right, yeah. So these nonverbal choreographies occur within corporations. The people who start out when they're young and grow up in the corporation, essentially, they're there 20, 25 years, know them very, very well. They know how to do the dance. There's no way for somebody like me to learn. Even if you tell me about it, I can't learn the intuition necessary, just like because there's so much involved, just like riding a bike.
How did that affect you?
Well, at the time, it was very disappointing, but I loaded up and got a job in the Chicago area, which was fun. That was a different set of dynamics, and maybe we can talk about that on another show.
I know. Well, let me ask you this. I mean, what do you have any advice that you could give someone? Actually, two different people. One is, if you're just a listener, not on the spectrum, you know, involved in corporate life, could you give someone some sort of piece of advice to, I don't know, to help them understand a person on the spectrum that's working in their environment?
Well, I would say this. In some ways, we appear childlike because I'm very right-sided. Many of us are. We learn and we're interested continuously. That does not mean, though, that we are functioning at the maturity level of a child. It means we keep the childlike curiosity and analytical part our entire life. Secondly, if it comes to a point where you believe that somebody doesn't understand what you're saying, be sure of what you are saying and what you're communicating in a very literate or verbal sense. If it comes to the point where somebody just doesn't understand, retreat and review how you're thinking about what you're communicating and also how you feel about what you're communicating. Because if you have this sense that you just can't say what you really mean because of customs or a personal inhibition or sensitivity, you need to find a way around that. Does that answer your question, Kim?
No, I think that's good advice. I think it just encourages people to actually think about what before they speak, before you speak, and also to just be considerate. I mean, not everybody, autism or no autism, is going to understand each other 100% of the time. And communication, thinking about your communication and making an effort is always a good thing.
Right.
You know, I guess my next question would be, if could you give a tip or piece of advice for a person on the spectrum in the corporate world right now?
Boy, that is a toughie, because the corporate world, to be very honest, is not ready. Paul made a very important statement about the two halves of the bridge. When it comes to many demographic groups, that half of the bridge exists from the corporate world. Right now for us, it does not. So, Kim, I'm sorry I'm empty-handed as far as giving those people a real strategy, although I will underscore the urgency of what Paul has told us he's doing, because advocacy work is very important, and it is now, to be very honest, mostly up to the corporate world to do their part in this. Paul, I kind of talked on your behalf. Do you agree, disagree?
No, I think I agree. I mean, I think that, you know, that's the big thing I've been working toward right now, is just this idea that it really does need to be built, a bridge needs to be built from both sides, that a lot of us who are considered high functioning, we really are doing the best we can. And, you know, but that doesn't mean that, you know, we've got everything covered, and we really do need some cooperation, and it needs to be a cooperative effort. We don't need people doing stuff for us, but we can't do everything ourselves either. It needs to be a meeting.
Well, and a lot of it is attitude and communication change. And the metaphor I use is this, and I do have somewhat of a monotone voice, and I'm a very verbal communicator. What I say is this: you know, there was a time when people thought that because somebody may talk in a particular voice, you know, sometimes it's black voice, woman voice, whatever, that it's just not the same as somebody else. There comes a time to say, listen, it's no longer reasonable to say that you need to continue your work to be like a particular demographic before you are acceptable. We are at that point now. We've, in many ways, done what we can, and functionally it is enough. The story that I just told, if I had been given reasonable instructions and a legitimate project, I would have been fine. So in that particular case, the company that hired me brought me in to be part of bogus, phony politics. And that has to change, at least when you are dealing with an autistic person.
Thank you so much, Rob. We're coming to the end of the show, and we really appreciate you being here and sharing your experiences. Definitely want to have you back at some point. I'm looking forward to you and Paul meeting. Paul, I'm going to email you about that. We're going to set something up. But I just wanted to let everybody know, because this is our last show before it happens, is World Autism Awareness Day is coming up April 2nd. And if you go to facebook.com/ World Autism Awareness Day, there's going to be lists of different events all around the world. And so you can look it up and decide to participate, support. We just want to thank you again, Rob, and thank all of our listeners for tuning in. And we will see you next, or hear you, or speak to you next month. Okay.
Thank you.